And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. In fact, this is the first edition of 2020, and it is with a good friend, Dr. Jay Richards. I'm always trying to bring people to my audience that are interesting, informative, and inspirational, and Jay fits the bill perfectly. Before we actually talk to Jay, I want to make sure that you're subscribing to the Hank Unplugged podcast. If you're doing so on iTunes or YouTube, make sure that you leave a review. Here's one I read today. High quality, down to earth, high caliber content, relevant topics. Hank recommends it, so do I. No commercial breaks, many episodes I wish were longer. Thanks, Hank. Your humble pursuit of truth has been absolutely critical in my faith walk and all the people at CRI that make it possible. God bless all of you. Well, again today, a special edition of the podcast. And I suppose I say that every single time, but anytime I do a podcast with Jay Richards, I consider it special. He's executive editor of The Stream. He's a research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He holds a PhD with honors in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary. He's the author of many books, and of course, we've done podcasts with Jay on some of those books, including the book Money, Greed, and God, The Christian Case for Free Enterprise. He was the co-author of the hugely popular book and video, The Privileged Planet. Also, several months ago, we offered Jay's book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. And now I am thrilled to feature on this podcast Jay's brand new book. It's out this month, the month of January. It's titled Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul. It's a Christian guide to fasting. It's released by Harper One. And I did an endorsement, which is on the back of the book, that says this: Richards is a polymath, one you can trust. And Eat, Fast, Feast is trustworthy and true. If you're confused about when to eat and when to abstain from eating, don't delay. Read today. I did. And the results have been transformational. Sort of interesting how this book fell into my lap. I had just finished my book, Truth Matters, Life Matters More. And I was deciding on who I would get to endorse the book. And one of the people I thought about immediately was Jay Richards. Well, I asked him to endorse the book, and he wrote back, yeah, I'd love to read it. Wrote a great endorsement. He said, is it possible for Hank to do an endorsement for my new book? So I got an advance copy. I read the book, but the timing of that was incredible. Some of you may remember that I did a transplant exactly 204 days ago now. So I'm 204 days out from the transplant. Well, to do the transplant, a stem cell transplant, you have to be in remission. And it was very, very difficult for me to go into remission. They were trying all kinds of chemotherapies and nothing was really working. The tumors were very aggressive. They were throughout my body. They were protruding from my body, under my jaw, in my neck, two huge ones in my groin area. And nothing was bringing me into remission. Well, a priest in the Orthodox Church had sent me a documentary that he wanted me to watch on fasting. We watched the documentary, and the documentary starts with the practice of fasting back in the 50s in Russia. It migrates to Germany, eventually to USC. And we watched this documentary. I was so interested in it. I watched it with my special assistant, Stephen Ross. We watched it together. We decided on the basis of watching it that this was not just anecdotal evidence, but this was peer-reviewed evidence. We followed all the trails and decided, to make a long story short, that this would be the thing that I should do, and perhaps it would get me into remission. So before I would take a regimen of chemotherapy, I would fast a three-day water-only fast. And sure enough, I went into remission. The theory being that the chemotherapy would be more efficacious in destroying the cancer cells and less harmful on the good cells. Well, I did the transplant. I got the endorsement for my book from Jay. I got a copy of his book, started reading it, and lo and behold, Jay was singing a very similar tune. So this book, the very book that we're going to be talking about today, Eat, Fast, Feast, fell into my hands at exactly the right time. And so, Jay, I am indebted to you in many ways. You've been a great guest on the Bible Answer Man broadcast, on the Hank Unplugged podcast. I love what you've written, but this book has absolutely been transformational for me. So I'm glad with that long prologue to have you on the podcast today.
Hank, it's great to be with you. I mean, it really is quite a story. I mean, obviously, providential timing. And I, you know, my own discovery of fasting was in many ways really very serendipitous and not honestly as inspiring as the one you just told. I mean, it was essentially, I had tried fasting on and off for decades. My wife and I tried it in the 1990s when Bill Bright was talking about 40-day fasts and did it for a while, managed to do 24-hour fast and kind of, you know, just found it really hard. And we still do, you know, the kind of short fast that Catholics do, little tiny ones, you know, and abstentions from meat on Fridays during Lent, kind of minor things. But it was really only as a result of a medical procedure that I had to go 36 hours without eating anything. And it turns out I was actually eating a really low-carb diet at the time and noticed 36 hours in, that I felt really lucid. My brain was clear. My mind was clear. I was working out, feeling strong. I thought, this is very strange. So I thought, well, do it what everybody does. I Googled information on fasting, only discovered there's this growing trend, of course, starting in California, of people doing major fasts, and a growing body of scientific research extolling the various physical benefits of fasting, quite apart from the spiritual benefits. And so I just, the sort of irony of that, just about the time that most Christians, with the exception of Eastern Rite and Eastern Orthodox Christians, have quit fasting, tech bros in California and scientists would discover the physical benefits of fasting. And so the book is my attempt to try to connect those things, to say that, look, God has created us from the dust of the earth and the breath of God. We are this hybrid of the physical and the spiritual. There's no reason to assume that those things need to be separated. And if fasting is something that God wants us to do, which I think it is, we should expect that it's going to be beneficial, not just spiritually, but physically as well.
And it certainly has been for me. And I've often said that God is not interested in healing us physically. He's interested in healing the whole of us. We're body-soul unities, as you just alluded to. And I think that was very, very important in my digesting this book, because this book is not only dealing with the physical, but the metaphysical aspect of our humanity as well. And I was so intrigued by the way you tied together a diet, so to speak, and fasting. And I have for years just thrown up my hands with respect to dieting because I thought, I don't know what's true. You read so many different books on dieting, and new ones coming out all the time, so many different opinions. I didn't know who to trust, what to believe. When your book came, the reason I trusted this immediately is I trust you in areas that I know that I'm very conversant with. And so I decided this would be trustworthy as well, particularly because I know that you practice what you preach. In other words, this is not just something that you're writing about. This is something that you're actually doing. You're practicing this lifestyle. Not only that, but you practiced and taught things in the past that you no longer believe in the present because you had sort of bought into the typical narrative that's rampant in the culture.
No, that's right. I mean, what's funny about this for me is that this has always been sort of my avocational interest. I was a strength trainer in college, and so I not only helped train with weights and diet routines at sports teams where I went to college, but also any students as part of my job. If a student wanted to come in and get on a health and fitness plan, I would put them on it. In the time, this was the late 1980s, the conventional wisdom was eat a really, really low-fat, high-complex carbohydrate diet, and there's unfortunately, I've got former student colleagues out there that I'm, you know, I need to apologize to. But this was a kind of conventional wisdom that emerged in the 1950s. I think it was well-meaning, but new research has suggested something quite different. And so that was, you know, something I had to sort of overcome, this idea that, no, in fact, dietary fat is not the villain. It doesn't cause all of these health problems that we've been told. And in fact, the so-called standard American diet, where we eat very highly enriched, highly refined carbohydrates constantly in our diet, and we eat frequently throughout the day, that combination of grazing and simple carbohydrates all the time is actually a source of many of our problems, from type 2 diabetes and obesity and many other things. And so it was that sort of combination of things that, okay, we dropped out of fasting, at least Christians in general, in the body of Christ, right about the time that we started eating in such a way that makes, as it happens, fasting really, really hard to pull off. And so I realized that that's not actually a coincidence. Fasting is always supposed to be a sacrifice, but it shouldn't be torture. Whereas for most people, going even 4 or 6 hours without eating anything is torture. That should tell you, okay, we're doing something wrong, because that shouldn't be torture, because most of human beings, for most of human history, went extended periods of time throughout the year without eating, and they got by just fine. And so that it's kind of, in many ways, several different puzzle pieces that came together in this book. And as you said, it really started as experimenting on myself for a long time. I didn't set out to write a book on this. I was doing it for my own spiritual and physical health, and just, you know, found some of these missing pieces that hadn't all been put together.
What's interesting about what you're saying from my perspective is that the fasting and the eating together have changed me in terms of appearance. As I sit here right now, I'm 170 pounds. I was 214 for most of my tenure as president of the Christian Research Institute. My waist size is now 33 to 34, right in that range. And so my waist size is about half my height. Before, I would have had to be 7'6" based on my waist.
Right for a really tall guy.
If I was taller, it would have been better. But yes, this is actually not something that I'm talking about as though it's a great theoretical idea. This is something I put into practice. I went through your 40-day program. It's actually 46 days, but there is a magic, so to speak, and perhaps that's the wrong word to use, but there's a certain authenticity to using the number 40. So you didn't arbitrarily choose to start people on a 40-day program. It actually has a biblical basis.
It does. I mean, in that number 40, Christians that read the Bible all know this, you know, 40 years in the desert with the Hebrews who became the Israelites. There was Jesus 40 days in the desert of fasting before his earthly ministry. That number comes up a lot. And of course, in the Christian liturgical tradition, Lent is effectively a 40-day period. As you said, it's 46, because it's basically 40 regular days and 6 little mini feasts on Sunday. So it lasts 46 days. This is a long-standing Christian tradition that emerged precisely from early Christians sort of reflecting on Jesus's 40-day fast, a really hardcore fast that very few of us would ever actually be able to accomplish. But saying, okay, how can we enter in to this sacrificial time in the time leading up to the great feast of Easter? And so that's where Lent came from. And as it just so happens, if you're not used to fasting, and if you're not used to using this type, the part of your metabolism that allows your body to burn fat effectively, you can sort of think of the human body as a hybrid. We can burn sugar using carbohydrates, but our bodies can also convert fats into these fuels called ketones and use those perfectly well as well. But because of the way we eat, most of us don't ever actually produce a lot of ketones. We don't really use fat for fuel. And so if you've spent decades just eating the standard American diet, it takes you a little while for your body to get used to burning fats for fuel. And I argue that's actually what you need to be able to do to really sustain fasting for a lifetime. It takes about 40 days, as it turns out, for your body to make that transition where it's actually easy to do that. And so that's the 6-week plan in the book, is designed for people that have never really fasted or fasted successfully to slowly transition, I think, in the most painless way possible, to adjust your body and your practices and your habits so that fasting just becomes a part of your daily and your weekly and your seasonal lifestyle from here on out.
Until I started following this method, I mean, I was never able to get rid of my stomach. My stomach is gone.
Wow.
I have a couple guys sitting here in the studio that can look at me. I'm telling you the truth. I have no stomach anymore. It's gone. But that's because I've been burning that fat. This was a fat reserve, right? Yeah. So I've been burning fat instead of burning sugar. I've turned from a...
No, that's right. Yeah, and it's a really good design for most of human history. If you think about, okay, for most of human history, people would sometimes, you know, especially if you're in a hunter-gathering lifestyle in which you're hunting animals, you have a bounty, and so you eat it, but you don't have a refrigerator, so you don't have a lot of really easy ways to store that stuff. And so you eat as much as you can. You might add a little extra weight, but then you might go long periods of time where you don't have a whole lot to eat, especially during the winter, and your body would need to be able to use those reserves. So if you have fat reserves on your body, that's food energy that your body is reserving for a time when you don't have a lot of food. And then you're able to kick into that fat-burning metabolism. It uses that rather than storing it. The irony of our modern way of eating is we're basically telling our bodies, burn only sugar, just use all the sugar, and any extra that you eat, store that as fat on your body, but put it away really far away, like in a deep freeze where your body can never access it. And so we can be walking around with 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 extra pounds of food energy on our bodies, and yet it's sequestered so that our bodies can't actually use it. That's the irony. And so we actually end up scrambling what is actually a really good design for getting us through periods of food scarcity. But the blessing of the modern age is that most of us never encounter food scarcity, and that is indeed a blessing, but it comes with this cost if we don't recognize and replicate in our lifestyles this kind of more natural pattern of eating, that is eating modestly most of the time, fasting some of the time, and feasting every so often. That's the pattern, the kind of punctuated pattern in life that I think God has designed us to live. And we've gotten out of that so that we just basically eat all the time, and then we feast some of the time too, which just means eating more than we normally do. That's not the pattern that I think is best for our design plan.
There's a certain resistance that people have to fasting, particularly in the Christian world. First of all, the general population, fasting, people are just used to gorging, particularly in America, and gorging on the wrong foods. But Christians are also a little reticent about fasting. It's as though this is a works-based kind of an idea. You have images in your head, as you write about in the book, about extreme cases of fasting and abstinence. And so, since the time of Ulrich Zwingli, there has been sort of a bias against fasting, very much like there's a bias in the Christian world today against the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. Talk about that and how to overcome that bias.
Absolutely. And I'm aware of this in large part because it was in my own mind for a long time. I thought of, especially if I thought about, you know, my Catholics that I knew marginally, and I knew, well, they ate fish on Fridays, and that seems sort of arbitrary if you don't have the kind of historical context for it. And then I knew, well, Jesus never really explicitly commanded us to fast. Yes, he fasted, but he never told us to do it, so I don't see that maybe it's not all that important. And then, as you said, it's just hard to do if you try it, and you think, okay, this is going to be a spiritual discipline, and you're just fixated on food and dreaming about donuts. It's hard to see how that's going to sort of bring you into a deeper relationship with the Lord. And as you said, sort of early, even though Calvin and Luther themselves didn't oppose fasting and in fact participated in it, Zwingli was actually sort of really hostile to it because he associated it with the works righteousness of the Catholic Church at the time. And so that was a kind of mental association. And so that has continued into the present, so that a few decades ago when Richard Foster, the great evangelical Quaker who wrote wonderful books on spiritual disciplines, wrote a book on fasting, he said he could find almost none in the evangelical world at the time. Some of that has changed. Certainly in the 1990s, Bill Bright with Campus Crusade for Christ started talking about fasting. But nevertheless, it tends to be this kind of episodic thing where there'll be a sort of fasting craze in which Christians will do it for a little bit, but then it peters out. And I think in part that's because the way we're eating and our lifestyles are so contrary to it. But also I think it's because we tend to be sort of pulling ourselves up by our own bootstraps. And in fact, if we look at the wisdom of the ages, if we look at the sort of long span of human history, what we find is that Christians fasted at particular times during the week and according to the particular liturgical seasons around Easter and Christmas. And so we were sort of we're locked in some ways, sort of external to ourselves, and it become a real thing. And so if we look at Christian history, not just since 1517, but since the very beginning, look at what early Christians did for 1,000 years at least, and what many Christians do to this day, we find that fasting is a central part of the Christian life. It's as central as praying and gathering together in worship. And it's just something that, unfortunately, we have mostly dropped in the modern age. And I am absolutely convinced that it's the thing that we need to recover if we're going to really see spiritual renewal across the body of Christ.
Let me just augment what you said. I mean, if you go to the Old Testament, you'll find that Esther fasted from food and water for 3 days and 3 nights and then begged the Jews in the province of Susa to do the exact same thing. And through that, they averted the genocidal plot of Haman, who was the personal advisor to the Persian king Xerxes. And then Saul was 3 days without sight. He neither ate nor drank, and thereafter there fell from his eyes what are described as scales, and he received his sight. He arose, he was baptized. You think of the church at Antioch. They fasted and prayed as Saul turned. Paul was being set apart for his glorious commission as apostle to the Gentiles. And you alluded to this as well, the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus places fasting on par with prayer and almsgiving as an act of righteousness, not to be seen by men, but by our Father who sees what is done in secret. I want you to elaborate on that a little bit, because Jesus is tying together prayer, almsgiving, and fasting as a three-braided cord. All three are graces that we learn within the context of the church, and they're transformative.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the funny thing, is you say, okay, well, Jesus didn't command us to fast, and that's because he assumed that his followers would fast. In Matthew 5, he says, when you pray, when you give alms, when you fast, don't look dismal like the hypocrites. In other words, when you do these things, if they're spiritual realities, you don't want to try to get an external reward by wandering around and being ostentatious about it. But of course you're going to do it. You wouldn't say, well, Jesus didn't command us to give alms. No, he presupposed we were going to do that. And as you said, tying these things together, we think of prayer, obviously, as a supremely spiritual thing we do. We think of alms as an artificial division, but we think of giving alms, okay, well, that's social justice. That's sort of helping people. Yes, we're supposed to do that too. And then fasting, well, we're not sure exactly what that is, but here we have in Jesus, really, his command, where he presupposes this, all these three things together. And I think that's a perfect example of the unified view that we ought to have as Christians and that Christ, of course, models for us. It wasn't Christ, God didn't just come down as a ghost. He came to earth as a human being, born as a baby in a manger. He lived a normal human life from conception and birth through death. He is human, body and soul, not just a sort of God pretending to be a human being. And in the incarnation, he specifically chose a natural fast. We assume probably he drank water in the desert, but he fasted for 40 days so that he was physically hungry at the end. This is a very physical reality. And I think that when we over-spiritualize the faith, when we try to say, well, all this stuff's sort of symbolic, it doesn't have anything to do with our bodies, we're kind of distilling out part of the message of the gospel, which is at a certain level, absolutely a physical thing. We believe not just in the immortality of the soul, but the resurrection of the body. And I think part of the truth of that is lost precisely because we've dropped out and quit fasting as an essential part of our prayer life.
And a lot of people are thinking, well, you're appealing to what Jesus said, and I'll go along with that, but why appeal to what the early church did? And they forget the progression from Jesus to the apostles mm-hmm. and then the apostolic fathers and the holy fathers and to every Eucharistic assembly throughout the land. So there's a lot of weight you put on the teachings of the early church that sometimes is minimized in the modern day church.
Yeah, and that is a temptation. I think that there's no reason why if a person is Catholic or Orthodox or Protestant that they need disregard that with the early church, but I think there tends to be a reflexive kind of attitude that, okay, sort of nothing important happened, I don't know, maybe from the end of the writing of the New Testament until, you know, sometime in the 16th century in Europe. That's really just you know, if you just step back, that's a really odd view to have, that the people that were closest in language, in culture, in geography, that knew, either knew Jesus directly or knew his disciples or were taught by his disciples, this idea that they wouldn't have anything important to say or to teach us is just an extraordinary thing. It seems like, all things being equal, somebody that speaks the same language that Jesus did, that lives within 100 or 200 miles of where he was on the earth, and that is still in the same culture, that they're likely to understand pretty well what Jesus taught and what he handed down. And so when you find something that's practiced unanimously, as fasting is, this wasn't just an exotic thing that one or two church fathers tried. You can just, you know, every single one of them talks about the miracles and the importance of fasting as a part of the basic Christian life. This is just utterly taken for granted. And so I would treat that as sort of overwhelming evidence that, you know, we should at least give the benefit of the doubt to this practice. And if we're going to not do it, we should have really, really good arguments, I think, to overcome what is really a kind of abiding precedent of Christian practice throughout history.
I want to talk for a moment about the structure of your book, because when I got the book, I read it almost like a novel. I love the way it was formulated, because you're not just dealing with the food pyramids or the way that you ought to eat. It's always interlaced with the fasting. So the structure of the book was very fascinating to me, and it was a very easy book to read.
Well, it's funny, because the longer I've been at the writing craft, the more I've really committed myself to trying to write simply, not simplistically, but simply, so that, you know, if a person is an educated seventh grader, they would be able to understand my book. Because I've always felt like it was a failure if somebody said, well, that really seemed important, but it was over my head. That meant that I had failed. I had not communicated to that person what I really wanted to communicate. And so I do think this book, if somebody is used to reading The Privileged Planet, which was definitely written at a kind of higher academic level, this one's written, even though there's a lot of science in this book, I tried to write it so that an educated middle school student would be able to read it. I did ultimately finally structure it around this 6-week plan, because I just thought, okay, most people that are reading the book are going to want kind of basic instruction on how to do this. And I realized that, you know, the more you fast, when you first start out, I mean, I wanted to make this easy. And so I actually encourage readers to, for the first week, not even try to do anything that you would think of as fasting, but just to eat ketogenically. In other words, to eat in such a way that your body will get rid of the sugars and the carbohydrates it's used to using, and will rev up this fat-burning metabolism. And so that requires that you don't eat a whole lot of carbohydrates, that you eat a pretty high-fat diet and moderate protein diet. But when you do that, after a few days, your body starts producing these ketones, which are, again, these fuels that your body takes fat, it converts it to ketones, and then your cells are able to use that as energy. But once you're in that state called ketosis, where your body is producing, your liver literally producing these ketones that your body can use for fuel, fasting becomes easy, because your blood sugar is really stable at that point. It's on the low side of normal. You're not feeling these blood sugar spikes that are tempting you to, you know, eat 3 bowls of cereal. And then when you fast, yeah, your stomach might feel sort of hungry, but it's actually fairly easy. But then instead of going straight into long fast, of course, as you know, because you read the book, each week you basically limit the time window in which you eat a little more. So that the second week you limit it so that you just eat all of your meals within an 8-hour time window, and you leave 16 hours of a 24-hour day without eating. And so you're basically increasing the amount of time that your body goes without having food put into it. And then the next week you limit it to 4 hours. So in other words, 20 hours out of the day, you don't eat, and eat all your food in 4 hours, and then so forth over a period of a few weeks, until you finally get down to where you're eating a couple of days in 1 week, just about 500 calories, just about a fourth of what you would normally eat. By that point, you are ready to do 24, 36, 72-hour fast without a whole lot of trouble, actually. But it's something that somebody had never fasted and suddenly decided they're going to go 3 days without fasting. It would be absolutely brutal. And so I ended up structuring the book around that plan, and then interlacing the spiritual and the physical benefits as individual chapters structured around the 6-week plan.
Very, very different than any diet book I've ever read before. I love to read this book. C.S. Lewis said that an unlettered man is a man who reads a book only once. And this is a book that I've read now from cover to cover 3 different times.
Wow.
On top of that, I've gone back and accessed the book for questions that I might have had. So this is not a book that I recommend that people get and read once, because it's so easy to get away from it. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to start to fudge on some of the principles. And I want to start with one of the principles that you've underscored in this book, and that is intermittent fasting, mm-hmm. which, for example, last night, my last meal was at 4:30. My next meal, which was today, the first meal of the day, was at 11:30. Mm-hmm. So I had an intermittent fasting period of time, and you're talking about the health of doing that very thing, and you're saying that though breakfast is a dead metaphor, it really does allude to intermittent fasting.
It does. I mean, this is the sort of current term of art, as you said, intermittent fasting, but that just essentially means that there should be periods of time during the day or during the course of the week when we don't eat, and periods of time when we do eat, and those should actually be separated. So as opposed to what I had taught for years, that, well, if you want to keep your blood sugar level, if you want to keep your body holding on to muscle and you don't want your body to store fat and go into starvation mode, you need to eat really frequently. You know, eat 6 small meals a day, and that will keep everything working really well. It turns out there's never any evidence for this, and now there's a lot of reason to think that's just a really bad idea. What intermittent fasting does, it just says, look, limit the amount of time during the course of the day when you eat, whatever it is. And so if you go, I mean, most of us, ironically, now eat essentially for effectively 16 hours out of the day, and then we go maybe 8 hours just while we're sleeping without eating, you know, and so we eat something right before we go to bed, and we eat something right after we get up, and then throughout the day. And so the first sort of step to make is just to switch that ratio to go 16 hours of the day. So in other words, that includes, of course, the night when you're sleeping, and eat during an 8-hour window. And that might, it seems difficult if you're not used to doing it, but this is roughly what people did until really the 1960s. I mean, even growing up in the 1970s and 1980s, I can remember this idea that, well, you know, don't eat a bunch of snacks. Eat 3 square meals a day and let that be it. And so that would mean you might eat breakfast at 8, you might have dinner at 5:30, and then you didn't eat again until the next morning when you broke your fast, when you had breakfast. Most of us, though, now we don't even manage to do that. And we now know, I mean, in fact, I had a hard time keeping up with it. The scientific papers coming out talking about various physical and metabolic benefits of actually doing this. And so now I think when I first started working on this, I felt like, gosh, this is sort of fringe and it will become controversial and it's moving to fashionable. But I think in terms of the physical benefits of this moderate intermittent fasting, I think the scientific evidence for it now is just absolutely overwhelming. And every single day, if you keep up with this stuff, there's another paper about it.
By the way, anecdotally, I can tell you that I used to have breakfast early in the morning because I start my day very, very early in the morning. And then by about 10:30, I'd have a horrible sugar low, and I couldn't wait to eat again. So I was just waiting to eat again. Now, not eating breakfast, most of the time, I don't eat my breakfast. I love eggs, and I love breakfast. So if I'm going to eat breakfast, I eat it at 11 or 11:30 or 12 o'clock, but I push it out. But I don't get the sugar low anymore.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the funny thing is that so many people, I mean, my wife jokes about it now because she's a pretty avid faster, but she was one of these people who said, oh, no, I think I must have hypoglycemia because I have to go, have to have something to eat every 3 or 4 hours. I just can't handle it. And that's true if you're eating in a certain way. But what we don't realize is that this isn't for most of us some kind of, you know, genetic propensity we have. It's just that we've gotten used to eating this way. We eat really simple carbohydrates that our bodies start converting to sugar the second we put it in our mouths, practically. And we do this frequently so that we're constantly perturbing our blood sugar. Our blood sugar, you don't want a lot of sugar running through your bloodstream. It's actually really, really dangerous. And so your body's really good at sweeping sugar out of your bloodstream. We can hold about a teaspoon or 5 grams of sugar in our bloodstream at one time. If you think about it, that's not a whole lot of sugar, right? It's like 1/6 of what you'd get in a soft drink. And so your body immediately has to get rid of that. And so what it does is your pancreas releases the substance, think of it as signaling hormone called insulin, that basically tells your cells, okay, absorb this sugar, get it out of your bloodstream. And we do this constantly to ourselves. And then that insulin goes up, it pushes the sugar out of the bloodstream, the insulin goes down, and then that signals, okay, give us some more sugar. And so signal goes to your brain, give me more sugar. And we're on this treadmill where we're actually training our body to keep asking for more and more sugar. And the more we do that, the more we need. And the more resistant our cells get to insulin, so the more insulin that our pancreas has to produce. And then we're on this vicious cycle. And once we're on that, then we think, well, this is just how I am. I can't do anything about it. No, you can. There's actually a way to get off this cycle in which our blood sugar stays steady and you don't have that kind of sugar high and low that most of us experience.
You know, the thing is, you're talking, Jay, that when I was playing in golf tournaments, before I'd actually tee it up, I'd think, I have to eat really healthy today because I want to play really well. And so I'd have a banana and I had some oatmeal. And when I'd start the golf tournament, I'd always sort of had the shakes. And it wasn't because I was nervous. It was I just had the shakes. And I didn't realize until I read your book that it's not just a bad habit of drinking Coke, which I never did, but it's not just that. But you can eat certain foods early in the morning for breakfast that turn to sugar in your system right away. And then you get those shakes and then you get that odd feeling that has to wear off. And sometimes it'd take one or two holes for it to wear off. And by that time, I was two or three over par.
That's right. It doesn't take long. And that's the irony because, I mean, I was always the same way. I mean, I probably haven't had a regular soft drink full of sugar in 20 years. I just, you know, I knew that. I mean, even in the 80s, when we were all supposed to eat low-fat, high-carb diets, we knew that sugar was just straight sugar, especially liquid sugar, was not good for us. And so that's the one thing that all these diet regimes all kind of shared in common. What I didn't realize is, you know, yeah, I always ate oatmeal. I ate lots of bananas and lots of fruit. And, you know, under certain contexts, I'm not saying those are bad things, but if that's the kind of main source of calories and you're doing this to yourself constantly, you're doing it to yourself first thing in the morning, even if you think you're doing the healthy thing, you could still be as much on this cycle as somebody that's, you know, eating donuts and drinking apple juice every morning, ironically.
Talk about dietary fat. We've been told for years and years and years by those that are authorities on diet that dietary fat is bad, that saturated animal fat is super horrible for us. That now turns out to be mythology.
That's exactly right. I mean, what's funny, Hank, is that I was actually had been reading the literature on this before I ever got into fasting. It was about 6.5 or 7 years ago. I had, you know, I had heard people that tried low-fat stuff, and I had heard about this book, Good Calories, Bad Calories, by a guy named Gary Taubes, that was a Science magazine writer, arguing essentially that most of this conventional wisdom of supposed nutrition science is actually wrong. It's based on a couple of flawed studies and then a bunch of advocacy groups, but that in fact, what's happened is that we've gotten worried. We started panicking in the 50s and 60s and 70s about animal fat and natural fat. We replaced it with a bunch of artificial fat from industrial seed oils and from things that aren't oily, things like cottonseed, right? Things that are not naturally oily, and we stopped eating that. And then, of course, we got to eat something. And so what's happened is we've dropped the amount of natural fat from our diets as we've increased the carbohydrate and the sugar content, and then that correlates perfectly with the increase in obesity and type 2 diabetes and other so-called metabolic diseases that have just been absolutely epidemic proportions now in the West, in places that replicate this diet. And it really should be counterintuitive if you kind of take the long view. If you look at how animals that eat, what they do, you know, if a lion kills an elk or something, it actually goes for the fatty portions. You know, that's what it focuses on. And so what we've essentially done in the last half of the 20th century is this kind of vast countrywide, and in some ways civilization-wide experiment in which we drop out these natural sources of nutrients and calories. We add these artificial kind of nutrients and calories in the form of industrial seed oils. And then we vastly expand the amount of sugar that we're eating. And at some point, somebody had to connect the dots. And over the last several years, there have been a number of groundbreaking books from Gary Taubes, whom I mentioned, Nina Teicholz, who wrote a terrific book called The Big Fat Surprise, which really exposed just how bad these nutritional studies and advocacies have been that have convinced us that fat was bad. And so I was already very interested in that and already been testing this. I've been testing ketogenic diet eating and low carb diets. And so I was already kind of primed for that. And in many ways, I had my own intellectual prejudices to get over. The first one was the dietary fat thing, which was the big one. The second was just the idea that it could actually be good for you to go a long period of time without eating, because I thought, well, that's going to put my body into starvation mode. Turns out, again, if you look at the scientific literature on this, it's just not true. And so we're kind of in this lag period in which a lot of the popular imagination in the U.S. News and World Report dietary reports are way behind the times and behind the actual scientific literature, which is actually, I think, on the cutting edge, is telling us a lot of this stuff. And if you're interested in it, you can actually find it, but you've got to get below the headlines, unfortunately.
Talk about the myth of a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, that all calories are created equal. And therefore, you take in a certain amount of calories, you have to do a certain amount of exercise to offset it.
Yeah, it's essentially treating our body as if it's a simple energy system. Because, yeah, in terms of the physics, it's true that fat per gram has 9 calories, whereas protein and carbohydrates have 4 calories. And so you say, if all it has to, you know, our body's the only thing that matters is the amount of food energy that goes in, yeah, that would be true. The problem is that our bodies are not simple thermodynamic systems. We're complex biological systems, so that every input creates a particular response. Our bodies are like thermostats. So, I mean, my best example in my own life was my life as a high school student. I was my sophomore year, I think I was 6'3", about 137 pounds. I had worked my way up to about 153 pounds. By the time I was a senior in high school, eating everything I possibly could. Now, the calories in, calories out should say, well, okay, so why wasn't I gaining a huge amount of weight? Well, the reason is the more I ate, the more calories my body used. It would just kind of crank up the energy. And so my body would just use up more energy. That's the kind of basic fallacy of this idea. It's not that calories are unimportant. It's just that our body responds differently depending upon what we're putting into our bodies. And so if you eat, for instance, a very high fat, very low carbohydrate diet, your body's actually going to use more calories on average than if you're eating a high carbohydrate, low fat diet. You're going to be warmer. Your body's going to be more thermic energy that your body is producing. And so that's the kind of key thing that's missing in a lot of these, well, you know, eat less, move more types of dietary advice, is that our bodies respond differently to different kinds of food inputs. And so we're not just consuming abstract calories or generic calories. We eat foods that have particular effects on our metabolism. And depending upon what they are and how we mix them, they're going to have different effects. And so that's the kind of key thing that's missing. It's really easy to think of our bodies as just, okay, the only thing that has anything that matters is how many calories I eat. That's simple to remember, but to have to think about these macronutrients and the way they affect our insulin levels and blood sugar, it's a little more complicated. And so, unfortunately, we've been fed this kind of, it's really a kind of cartoonish understanding of human physiology and metabolism that doesn't serve us well.
By the way, there's nothing complicated about the book. Once you get the major premise, it's stuck in your mind and you can apply. But to that end, I want you to deal with something that I'm sure is in the back of the minds of a lot of people listening to us right now, and that is that they have been burned by diets over and over again. They go on a diet, they lose the weight, but then they end up gaining the weight and then some more. And then they find another diet and they do the same thing. So they've been burned so many times, they now come across your book and they say, you know what? What if I go on this and the same thing happens once again? What's your response?
I mean, that is an honest response that I expect, and I get this question from a lot of people. Here's the key thing. Almost any diet that you go on will work in the short run, and then it will fail in the long run. And I don't need to tell your listeners this. Anybody that's tried it knows this is true. It's exactly what happens. But the reason is because most diets involve persistent calorie reduction, in which you decide, okay, I'm going to eat a little less, and I'm going to do that every day until I get to my target weight. Well, that works in the short run for most people. You can go on a low-fat, you can go on a low-carb diet, there's all sorts. You can go on a grapefruit diet. Almost anything you do that changes the way you eat from the standard American diet is almost always an improvement in the long term. But here's the problem. is that doing that kind of persistent calorie reduction changes your metabolism. And so if you keep eating less than your body needs, what your body does is it just slows down its metabolism to adjust to that kind of lower level of food intake. And you will, in fact, if you do that for a long period of time, you actually lose some of the lean body mass that you have. In other words, you lose some muscle, so your body's not using as many calories. Well, and so what happens is that if you start eating again the way you were, you've got a slower metabolism now, and so your body's going to be in the mode where it wants to store fat at that point. That's the difference between dieting and fasting. Fasting doesn't do that. Persistent calorie reduction will lower your metabolism and slow your resting energy expenditure. That's a technical term. Fasting doesn't do that. It turns out if you do a water-only fast for 24 hours, your metabolism actually goes up. So the amount of energy that your body is using goes up. It releases certain hormones like norepinephrine that increase our metabolism. It releases human growth hormone, which preserves the lean muscle mass. So it does exactly the opposite of what you'd expect. In fact, you actually have to fast for about 5 days to get your metabolism in the same level that it was before you fasted. So in other words, you could fast for 5 days straight and you still wouldn't have appreciably slowed down your metabolism. And so really just the simple answer is that the physiological effects of intermittent fasting, where you don't fast all the time, but you fast sometimes and you eat sometimes, is completely different than the metabolic effects of persistent calorie deprivation, which is what most diets involve.
So a lot of people perusing your book very quickly and not paying attention to the details say, oh, this is a keto diet. So basically, high fat, moderate protein, low carbs, get most of my carbs from vegetables. I've heard of that before. But this is not a keto diet per se. It's a keto plus. And that plus is not just an add-on, it's inextricably woven together in the fabric of what you do, and that, again, is fasting.
That's exactly right. I mean, I do think, and I draw on the keto diet literature, and it's really because there are only two ways to get your body into ketosis. And ketosis, I argue, is if you can't get your body doing that, you're never going to be successful at fasting. And there are really only two ways to do that. You can either not eat for 3 days. That's the hard way to do it. Just stop eating. Your body will eventually quickly use up all the sugar that's stored in your muscles and in your liver, and then it'll start producing ketones. That's the tough way to do it. The other way is just to eat ketogenically for 3 days. That's the easy way to do it, where you eat lots of fat. In fact, you boost the amount of fat. You drop the carbohydrates way down. So really, your only carbohydrate intake when you're doing this would just be sort of green leafy vegetables and stuff like that. And within about 3 days, your body is going to be producing ketones. So that ketosis state is absolutely important. But I don't tell people that they're going to have to eat a ketogenic diet permanently. What I think that sort of ideal long-term goal is that you would be metabolically flexible. And that just means that your body can either be in that normal kind of sugar burning state where it's taking glucose or sugar and turning it into glucose, or in the ketosis state where it's taking fats and turning them into ketones. And after you do this for a few months, your body gets used to doing that. But when you first do it, it's kind of like, again, it's like if you think of your body as a hybrid, like a Toyota Prius, that's just constantly having the battery recharged and it never actually uses its gasoline tank at all. Well, when it first uses its gas, if that's been sitting in the tank for months, it's going to be a little sluggish. And that's unfortunately where most of us are. But 2 or 3 months out when you've been doing this, your body will be used to adjusting between these two different states, and you'll be able to find the level of carbohydrate tolerances that are right for you.
Talk about how carbs raise your blood sugar and provoke an insulin response. So you have this hormone that becomes a gatekeeper, but there's a big downside to that.
There is. And this is the sort of complicated thing that obesity and diabetes researchers, you know, had to figure out. I mean, we talk about type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, but they're really two different things. And what ultimately leads to type 2 diabetes is so-called insulin resistance. And that's what happens when you're constantly raising your blood sugar level to dangerous levels over and over and over again over a long period of years. So in other words, if you're perfectly healthy and you just drink 3 regular Cokes, right, that's going to boost your blood sugar. That's going to lead to any kind of permanent physical damage. But raising our blood sugar constantly to dangerous levels, it's like smoking. Smoking one cigarette's not going to kill you, but smoking 3 packs a day for 25 years is a really bad idea. And so what happens is we consume something that immediately gets converted to sugar. So essentially, almost any carbohydrate is going to do this, but certainly simple carbohydrates. That immediately sugar enters into our bloodstream and it gets above a certain level, and our body is very good at getting that sugar out of the bloodstream because it's very bad for your veins and your arteries and your organs to have high blood sugar. And the way it does this is with this signaling molecule called insulin that's produced by your pancreas. And so your pancreas sends a signal out into your blood, insulin, and insulin is essentially a signal that tells all the cells in your body, open up and take some of this sugar, right? So it's literally what it does. And then if it's working properly, those cells open up and they absorb the sugar from your bloodstream. And then the insulin goes down and your blood sugar levels drop back down into normal levels. Now, our body, if you're healthy, is really good at doing this, and it does it really quickly. But if you do this constantly, so you're constantly having high blood sugar, what happens is that your cells can only take so much of this. They themselves can only take so much sugar. And so they start resisting, sort of putting up the barriers to absorbing more sugar, but you still got too much sugar in your blood. So what's going to happen? Your pancreas is going to produce even more insulin to get the cells to open up to absorb that sugar and take it out of your bloodstream. And so you keep this cycle going. Do this for years and years and years, and you end up with what's called insulin resistance, where effectively the cells in your body just are resistant to the effects of insulin. And then you get persistent high blood sugar, and you go to the doctor, and you've got really bad high blood sugar. And the way your doctor fixes that in many cases is by giving you more insulin. So you now are taking artificial insulin. That helps the problem in the short term. But again, it just treats the symptoms and not the problem. And so your body keeps doing this. And then, of course, in the meantime, what's been happening is all this extra sugar has been being stored as fat, subcutaneous fat under our skin, which is the kind we don't like to look at. It's not really all that unhealthy. But then so-called visceral fat. And the visceral, that's your viscera. That's your intestines and your liver and your stomach. In other words, storing fat around our hearts and our livers and our intestines. And that's where it gets really, really dangerous. And it can even build up around your pancreas and then mess up the pancreas's ability to produce insulin. So all of this, it's a problem that it accrues over years and years of eating a high carbohydrate, high sugar diet. And so the effects are only felt after 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years. But for most of us, if we're over 30 years old, we've been doing that.
Talk about the importance, Jay, of drinking lots of water, being hydrated.
Yeah, it's funny because this is the thing. I feel like I'm a broken record in the book, but I'm constantly reminding people when they're going through this regime to drink lots and lots of liquid and to keep up their electrolytes, so things like magnesium and sodium, and so actually increasing the amount of salt that they consume. And the reason is because, to sort of put it simplistically, I mean, the word carbohydrate, it's right in the word, so it has the word carbon in it, right, carbo, and then hydrate, as in water, hydrogen, right, H2O. Carbohydrates, they bring with them sugar molecules. And so your body, when you're eating a high carbohydrate diet, actually stores extra water. And so you actually, depending upon your size, might have 5 to 7 extra pounds of water that you're carrying around. When you start fasting, or let's say you start the transition plan and you do a ketogenic diet for a week, the first thing that's going to happen is that your body is going to flush all of that extra water. And when it does this, it also tends to flush some of the electrolytes that are in your system. And this is a lot of people that did the Atkins diet in the 1980s and 1990s had this thing. They would have an Atkins flu or a so-called keto flu where you felt dizzy and you just didn't feel quite right. You might even feel kind of nauseated. Turns out the reason is because your electrolytes are imbalanced because you're losing a bunch of water. Well, and so you need to counteract that when you're first doing this. And so it's sort of counterintuitive, but people that are first on a ketogenic diet for a week need to be drinking broth and things like that that have a lot of extra salt just to keep your electrolytes up. I also advise people when they first start doing this to kind of stay away from the scale. And the reason is because the first thing that happens when you start eating this way is you lose that water, and so all of a sudden you're 5 or 7 pounds lighter. And it might tempt you to think, okay, I'm going to lose 7 pounds a week as long as I stick to this. Well, you will slowly be losing body fat as well, but that first weight that you lose is actually all that extra water that you were holding on to because of the carbohydrates. And so that's something that if people have heard, well, I tried the Atkins diet back in the 90s and it made me feel sick. It was almost certainly because people didn't really understand this relationship about water and electrolytes. So if you're doing this, you just boost up the amount of water and you increase the amount of salt in your diet. And for most people that do that, they don't feel any of these weird symptoms.
That just seems like heresy when you mention salt. I have lots of salt, but I love it now. I mean, I have my vegetables, the spinach, but lots of salt on that. It just seems like completely the opposite of what I'm supposed to do. Tastes great, and it's good for me.
No, that's right. I mean, a lot of these things, if you actually look into the details, now, you know, look, if you have really, really high blood pressure, and so increasing salt in your diet can actually increase your blood pressure. But if you don't have that problem, there is absolutely no evidence that there are health problems with having a high salt diet or having salt in your diet. In fact, if anything, there's probably more bad things that can happen than good by doing that. And so this inordinate fear that we have of salt, it doesn't make any sense under normal circumstances, and it makes even less sense if you're eating ketogenically or you're fasting. You really need to keep up the salt intake in order to make sure that your electrolytes stay balanced.
You make the claim in the book that we have two brains. Cash that out for people, because it's absolutely true. I mean, it's a compelling case, but a lot of people don't think of it that way.
No, they don't. I mean, this is when I first heard this idea that we had two brains myself. I was actually very skeptical and had to look into it and very quickly discovered that, in fact, it's true. We actually have a bunch of neurons in our gut that is attached to our large intestine. Now, if you think of neurons as brain cells, well, they are, but they're not just in the brain. It happens. We have a bunch of them down in our gut. Moreover, we actually have, there's this kind of information superhighway, this powerful nerve that connects our brains directly to our gut that it turns out is very important. It's important for our emotions. It's important for our brain health. And I suspect that one of the reasons that there's this kind of amazing mental lucidity that you experience when you're fasting is this kind of information superhighway. We know that fasting changes the so-called microbiome, that is the organisms that live in our gut that we carry around with us. They actually do different things. They produce different chemical signals and transmit information to our brains. And so I think one of the things that's happening when we're fasting, one, we're producing a lot of ketones, and our brains really like to use ketones as a source of fuel. And the second thing is that we're changing up the types of critters that exist symbiotically in our gut, and those are also transmitting things to our brain. So this is all kind of cutting-edge stuff. This isn't anything that we really knew 20 years ago, but it's now not all that controversial that, yes, we've got this kind of brain-gut connection, we've got neurons in our gut, and that there's this mysterious connection between what's happening in our brains and what's actually happening in our gut with these critters that we carry along.
One of the most intriguing chapters in the entire book for me was a chapter that's titled Fasting to Fight Disease and Live Longer. And there you talk about a number of different things, including how this kind of eating pattern, how fasting alongside the eating pattern or inextricably woven together with the eating pattern can cure all kinds of diseases, actually, or stave them off.
That's right. And, you know, in many ways, this is the part of the book I almost wanted a whole separate book on this, but I couldn't do that. But this is kind of the cutting edge research. And as you know, Hank, one of the things that people are using fasting for is to basically make chemotherapy easier. So a lot of people, it's still, you know, somewhat controversial, but people that are undergoing chemotherapy have discovered that chemo is both more effective and actually much less difficult if prior to chemotherapy you undergo fasting. We've known for a long time that fasting has an effect on things like epilepsy. In fact, it was fasting and ketogenic diets were the really kind of only way of treating childhood epilepsy for a long time. But the cancer connection is the one that is the most fascinating to me, because it's been known for a long time that many cancer cells actually have a different metabolism than other cells. And so I'm simplifying things, but essentially most of the cells in your body can use either sugar for fuel or fat for fuel in the form of ketones. But it was discovered by a German scientist in the 1920s named Otto Warburg. He discovered that most cancer cells, because of essentially a break in them, are not good at using fat. They need to use sugar for fuel, which suggests that if you deprive your body of sugar, in other words, if you just use fat for fuel, you'll feed all of your normal and healthy cells and actually, in a sense, could be starving the cancer cells. And that, to me, is one of the most exciting things. It's still the kind of cutting edge of cancer research, but there are a number of very respected cancer researchers, including Walter Longo in California, that are actively researching this. I call it a tantalizing hypothesis in the book, but I really do think that we're going to discover some important stuff about the connection between fasting and cancer in the future.
I have no doubt about this because, you know, before I went into the transplant, I had to do a physical test and a mental test. They repeat it after like 100 days, I think, after you do the transplant, and they see if you've lost any mental acumen or any physical abilities. And I scored just as high afterwards as I did before. And I was involved intentionally during this whole period with the intermittent fasting. I did do, as I mentioned earlier in the podcast, I did the 3-day water-only fast to make the chemotherapy less damaging to my good cells and more efficacious in destroying the cancer cells. So, you know, again, it's anecdotal with me, but certainly I think it's been very helpful. But something else that you mention here is that I have a little neuropathy in my feet. Mm-hmm. There's the possibility of regenerating some of the nerve cells and so forth using these same methods.
That's right. And this is because of a process that's now well understood. But again, this is your recent information, is a process called autophagy. And autophagy just means literally from the Greek, it's sort of self-eating. But essentially, you could think of our cells as having these two different modes. They can have the kind of go-go mode where you're using energy and you're having to use your muscles to do stuff and you're eating, and so your body's actively having to metabolize and break down foods and store it and things like that. And that's the mode that when you're eating, your cells are going to be in, this kind of go-go mode. But there's also a recycle and repair mode in which your body, if it's under certain conditions, your cells will actually start repairing either some of just the metabolites and the sources of energy they may reuse, those simple proteins, but may actually repair and recycle some of the broken organelles. So you think of your cell as this kind of complex integrated factory, has hundreds of different kinds of systems inside it. Some of those things break down and they need to be repaired. Well, it turns out our cells have a mode in which they repair themselves. It's called autophagy. Now, but here's the interesting thing. Here's how it's connected to fasting. If you're eating constantly, you keep your cells in go mode rather than recycle and repair mode. So the main way to have your cells signal that it's time to repair is fasting. About 36 hours into a fast, your cells go into this stage of autophagy where they start recycling. So they recycle nutrients that they have. They break down and recycle parts. In fact, at the extreme, they even go into programmed cell death, where the cell basically kills itself. It's recycled in the larger system, and then a new cell is replaced. This is a really important kind of recent scientific discoveries, and the connection with fasting is just really much more recently has been made. And I suspect, and again, this level of kind of testable hypothesis, that it's this effect of fasting on autophagy, that is effect of fasting on cell recycling, that is the reason people are finding all these amazing health benefits to fasting, because it literally trains, you're signaling to your body, okay, slow down, settle down, and repair and recycle. Of course, that's what you want to do that with your car. You want to park your car. You don't want to run your car at 5,000 RPMs all the time. And you don't want to do that with your body as well.
So many fasting follies over the years. You mentioned some of them in your book. I know that you respected Bill Bright as I did, but he bought into a particular fasting paradigm that turns out to be very, very deflective.
Yeah, and this is in the 1990s, and Bill Bright, and this is the first time that I tried fasting. My wife tried fasting, was under inspiration from Bill Bright, and he felt called first to undergo a 40-day fast on his own and then to call American Christians to do this. It was before the turn of the next millennium. But he had gotten this idea, and so far as I can figure it out, it's really just kind of the juicing craze in the 1990s, which everybody kind of thought juicing was good for you. And so even though he advised a fast, it wasn't really a water-only fast. And so he advised that people drink fruit juices, drink vegetable juices, and boil potatoes, and then drink the broth of that. And they could do this sort of without limit as long as they didn't eat solid food. And, of course, he didn't realize that essentially what he was saying is you're going to keep your body in that sugar-burning mode so it can never access the stage of ketosis in which fasting is really most beneficial and most productive. And so that's sort of the irony is that, I think that's why it's important. Look, if God made us physical and spiritual creatures, then if we're careful about studying physical science and biology, we should be able to discover things about our bodies and figure out how best to fast so that our fasting regimes and our habits and patterns are not arbitrary things that we make up. In fact, they make sense spiritually and they make sense physically. And so you absolutely, if you're trying to do a prolonged fast, the last thing you want to do is to eat or drink a bunch of sugar. That's going to literally prevent you from getting in the state where fasting is beneficial.
So let's talk about the 46 days very quickly. It's 6 weeks. Maybe you can run through quickly what you're going to go through in 6 weeks. Reason I'm asking this question is obviously your book is forged around those 6 weeks, but I want to get to the fact that once you have accomplished this, you're then able to go on to bigger and better things, that there's a sweet spot in fasting for 5 days. And if you do that a number of times a year, you can accomplish a 40-day fast, but in a lot less prohibitive way. So I want people to understand that, because I'm at the place in my own life where looking at a 3-day water-only fast is not a daunting thing whatsoever. I sort of look forward to it because I know that there's going to be mental clarity that comes after the first 36 hours. I'm going to start feeling really strong. So the exact opposite of what you would expect takes place. Rather than it being daunting, it becomes liberating.
No, it really does. And I think the evidence for different effects of fasting, what we're finding, I think I'm speaking tentatively at the moment, is that different timescales have different spiritual and physical effects. So there's certain benefits on your blood sugar and your insulin levels just with the intermittent fasting. To get into that mental clarity, you need to go a little longer so you've got a lot of ketones in your system. And then to kick into that repair and recycle mode, I think you need to really have gone several days with a water-only fast. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look at the long Christian tradition on this is what early Christians did. They would fast, of course, every day in a sense, and that they'd limit the amount of time naturally when they ate during the day and then didn't eat it for long periods of time at night. They fasted every Wednesday and Friday. In fact, literally, most Christians didn't fast on Wednesday because that was the day Jesus was betrayed, and on Friday because that was the day he was crucified. Then they'd have a mini feast on Sundays. And then they had these larger liturgical seasons, especially Advent followed by Christmas, and then Lent followed by Easter, in which they replicated roughly this kind of Jesus 40 days in the desert, not with a 40-day water-only fast, but with really hardcore abstention. So in the Eastern Orthodox traditions, still to this day, it's a very restricted diet, certainly during the week, essentially a vegan diet for the most part, these long, intense fast. In the case of the Orthodox Ethiopians, about 250 days of the year involve some kind of fast. So it's a different kind of fast at a different time scale. And I call this fractal fasting. So like a fractal is a pattern that retains its pattern as you increase its resolution. You keep seeing patterns all the way down. I think God has intended for us to have a kind of fractal fasting pattern across our lives so that we're fasting at the daytime scale and a weekly time scale, the seasonal and the annual time scales. And each of those is going to have benefits. And I think they work best when they're done together. But as you say, this doesn't mean that it necessarily makes sense for most people to do a literal 40-day only fast. And I think the evidence suggests that you're much better off doing 40 days of fast spread out by, you know, sort of 3 days or 5 days throughout the year. And you'll get all of the benefits without nearly as many of the risks as a really long 40-day straight fast.
What does Darwin have to do with all of this?
Well, this is something that, as you know, is an abiding interest of mine. And when you read the fasting literature, when you read the paleo diet and the keto literature, there's this just this hardcore Darwinian assumption in which you argue, well, for millions of years, you know, our pre-human ancestors ate a certain way, and so therefore we should eat this way. And it's just a highly uncritical kind of Darwinian just-so storytelling in a lot of this literature. And so I wanted to disentangle that. But the irony is that a lot of these Darwinian stories, they kind of function as designer substitutes. So people just say, well, our bodies evolved so that they can survive in lots of different environments. And they can survive eating fat. They can survive eating a lot. They can survive not eating at all. And they just, you know, you just use the word evolve. And what they're really describing is this extraordinary design plan in our bodies that just screams design if you're open to it. And so toward the end of the book, I tie all this together and I say, in fact, natural selection is a real thing. Survival of the fittest is a real thing. Obviously, you know, if you've got a bunch of water buffalo and some are faster running and they don't tend to get eaten by the lions, they're going to tend to reproduce. So that natural selection is a real thing. It's just that it doesn't explain the arrival of the species. It just explains the survival of the species. And so, you want to put the kind of Darwinian mechanism in its place, but we should avoid this kind of overweening Darwinism that explains all of these things. And in fact, I've known some Christians that have been worried about this, worried about ketogenic diets and so-called paleo diets, precisely because there's so much Darwinian storytelling when you actually read the literature. And so I actually think there's a much more powerful argument for design in all this, for those at least that have eyes to see.
Yeah, so you're saying that Darwinism cannot explain the important thing, and that is the arrival of the species. It can, in some way, talk about what happens within kinds or within species in terms of modification or change. But there's never change from one species to another or one kind to another.
Exactly. I mean, we don't even, you know, anything that involves more than two or three coordinated mutations just never actually happens in nature. And so I do think this is, gives us some insight about diet. And so you could sort of think of it this way, that if humans have been eating a certain way for thousands of years, that ought to be given the benefit of the doubt. Because if it were actually really unhealthy for us, that would have gotten weeded out of the gene pool. You know, cultures that constantly eat poison don't stay around very long. And so if you're trying to decide, okay, should I eat natural fat, which humans have been eating since time immemorial, or should I try this kind of industrial seed oil that hasn't really been tested by the long course of human history? The benefit of the doubt ought to go with the thing that has antiquity in that case. And that doesn't mean that everything new is bad, but I think there's a kind of benefit of the doubt for something that has been sifted for hundreds or thousands of years of human history. It's probably likely not going to kill us, whereas if it's something brand new, it just simply hasn't been tested. And so I think that there's a reason for, you know, if you can use natural selection essentially as a filter across time, but if you're trying to use it to explain the system as a whole, this incredibly coordinated metabolism in which you can use all these different kinds of fuel at different timescales, it's just completely powerless to explain that.
Let's go back to the title of your book. We've talked about eating. We've talked about fasting. The last big word is feasting. And this is an important part of the book. You're saying that feast days are not cheat days.
That's right.
The first thing that comes to mind when we think about feasting, we're thinking about cheating, okay? We're finally going to have a little bit of a reprieve from this whole sordid mess, and we're going to gorge. But that's not a cheat day. There's a difference between a feast day and a cheat day. And in fact, you want people to repeat it over and over again, so it's part of their memory trace.
Exactly. I mean, because this is the problem. It's, well, this is my cheat day when I get to eat something I really like, you know, and I'm not torturing myself. But if you look, I mean, what's funny is it's the one thing that most of us as Christians have retained. We still celebrate Christmas and Easter, which are the feast days. And so I am absolutely not going to be the kind of person that's going to say the killjoy that says we shouldn't do that. The problem is that the feast always made sense in the context of this pattern of fasting and feasting. But what we have now is we just eat our fill constantly and frequently every day. And then on so-called feast days, we eat more than we normally do. And so that's the kind of temptation to think that it's actually, well, it's a cheat day. But first of all, who are you cheating? I mean, you're not cheating anyone. But if it's in this context of this punctuated way of eating, in which, in fact, you eat modestly most of the time, you do real fast part of the time, and then you occasionally do a feast, I think we should throw ourselves into that. I think that's what God intended for us to do. And in fact, this is the kind of way in which salvation history and biblical history is structured. We start out, as the church fathers often pointed out, a type of fast in the Garden of Eden, in which Adam and Eve are commanded not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then at the end, in the book of Revelation, there's this heavenly wedding feast in which we enjoy in the kingdom of God this feast with the wedding feast of the Lamb. And so this pattern of fasting and feasting, it should be a part of our daily lives. It's also a part of salvation history and our eternal lives. And we would be missing out on that if we never celebrated feasts. I just think that feasts end up actually losing some of their power and their meaning if they're not accompanied by fast as well.
Something else that I found interesting as I was going through your book originally, I was thinking, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this, I don't like this. I'm talking about in terms of food. Mm-hmm. But you make the point in the book that your palate changes over time. And I've experienced that with cancer because when I was going through the radiation and chemotherapy, I lost my taste buds completely. So I couldn't taste food at all. And then when the taste buds started coming back, coffee would taste like mud. Nothing tasted good. And you had to sort of force yourself to eat. But eventually, my taste buds came back. In the same sense, or in a similar sense, there's a way in which your palate actually changes where foods that seemed oppressive to you actually start tasting like sugar or start tasting sweet to you. So you start liking foods that you disliked before.
That's exactly right. We all know this. I mean, if you think about ourselves across the course of our lives, there are things that tasted terrible to us as children, like Brussels sprouts for me just tasted horrible as a child. Well, I really like Brussels sprouts now. And so we know that these things can change. And I'm not just lying to myself. I actually think that they taste good. But I know in my own experience with this, I loved the flavor of sweet things, and I never craved a salad. I ate salads. I never thought about them. But after doing this for a few months, your palate does change. If you cut out lots of carbohydrates, if you cut out sugar, you vastly increase the amount of green vegetables that you're eating, they actually start tasting sweet to you, and you actually start craving those things. I do think actually a shift in your microbiome is part of the picture, because depending upon what you eat most regularly, the critters that we keep in our guts are going to vary. If you have a high carbohydrate diet, you're going to tend to favor the organisms that like that. If you eat a high fat, very low carb sort of green vegetable rich diet, you're eventually going to end up with a microbiome that has those affinities. And I think it's probably sending signals. And so I actually think part of our cravings are the result of signals that we're getting from our gut. It takes a little discipline to shift your diet, but anybody that does this for a couple of months, you can test it for yourself. I mean, I tell people, look, unless you think this is going to kill you in a week, just try it for a couple of months, and you can persuade yourself simply by your own experience or not.
Talk about the pros and cons of wine, particularly red wine.
Yeah, and so I looked at this because, of course, the fate of red wine and wine in general on health tends to wax and wane. And so for years, we were told you shouldn't have any alcohol. And then much more recently, we've heard that at least moderate amounts of red wine are probably good for you. You know, I'm sort of undecided on that. I think it's highly unlikely that moderate amounts of alcohol and wine in particular are bad for us, simply because humans have been drinking wine for all of human history for all sorts of different reasons. And so my view is that, look, if you're trying to cut out all carbohydrates at certain times, and you're going to want to limit that just because it's a type of carbohydrate, but wines that are not especially sweet in moderate amounts, there's absolutely no reason to think that they're bad for you. I think there's some reason to think that it's probably good for us in moderate amounts.
The isms are always the problem, and you write in your book about nutritionalism. What's the issue there?
Well, the issue is essentially nutritionism is a form of reductionism in which we treat food just in terms of their nutrients. And this is really kind of the result of scientific research. So essentially, we learned how to isolate calories in food, the calorie content, that is the energy content of food. We figured out how to measure that in science really early on. And so the temptation is just to focus on that thing that we can measure and then ignore everything else. So meat, rather than being chicken that's from a particular place, or beef or eggs from a particular chicken, they're just fats or proteins, right? They just reduce them to their energy content. And then the macronutrients, which I just use those terms, carbohydrates, fats, and proteins, we figured out how to isolate those. And then later we figured out how to isolate vitamins and minerals, the so-called micronutrients. And so we just tend to reduce foods to their simple kind of chemical constituents that we can actually measure. But the reality is that foods come from organisms, which are amazingly complex things that we only partially understand. And so I think we should think of food, as organisms from things that God has created, part of the truth of which is that we can discern from chemistry. But we should never just reduce our food merely to fuel, because food, of course, has liturgical meaning. It has sacramental meaning. It has cultural and religious meaning, and has emotional attachments. And so I think we should strive for a life in which food is put in its place. It's certainly not a god and it's not an idol, but in which it's enriched and it has all of the kind of religious and nutritional value and importance that it ought to have. But let's not fall for this kind of 20th century attitude, which just reduces food to its chemical content.
You close the book by talking about the church fathers who made so much of the parallels between the Eucharist and the eschatological vision that you referred to a little earlier in the podcast, the vision of John in the book of Revelation, where the bridegroom carries the bride over the threshold of Jordan to the New Jerusalem. Talk about the parallels there.
Well, it's especially in the so-called Johannine literature, so in the book of John, of course, but also in Revelation, because he wrote those, Eucharistic symbolism is everywhere. I mean, the first miracle in the book of John is the wedding at Cana, when Jesus takes the water and turns it to wine. You know, any early Christian reading that's going to be thinking about the water of baptism and the wine of the Eucharist. And then, of course, in the book of Revelation, this finally this wedding feast of the Lamb at the consummation of all things. And I think we lose something if we just dismiss as a mere symbol the rich realism of what's going on there. I mean, I'm thinking about John 6 in particular, in which Jesus, you know, he tells the disciples, unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, or literally you chew my flesh and drink my blood, you have no life in you. And then some of the disciples say, well, this is a hard saying. Who can help this? You would expect, if Jesus is speaking metaphorically or symbolically, that either John as the narrator or Jesus would say, no, you're misunderstanding what I'm saying. But he doesn't do that. He, in fact, hardens the saying. And then as a result, some of the disciples actually leave and the apostles stay. And Jesus, you know, is wondering, well, are you guys going to go anywhere? And they say, well, no. They sort of accept that this is perplexing. It's paradoxical. We're not sure what you're saying. Well, now, so think about John in the early church writing this. What would he have to write to convince us that Jesus is speaking in some way realistically when he is talking about this, that in some mysterious way, this bread that we make with our hands and this wine that we make with our hands can be transformed into the body and blood of Christ so that we can participate in it, we can eat it and drink it and be transformed in our very being? It's just the sort of thing that would be appropriate to this religion that is at the very bottom about our physicality and our spirituality united into one. We are not just ghosts and machines, and we're not just apes descended from the trees, but we are this unique hybrid of the physical and the spiritual. And I think that that deep Eucharistic realism is just perfectly appropriate to that Christian understanding of the human person.
I think it's a perfect way to end the book, because the point you're making in the book is that we're body-soul unities, and when we feed ourselves properly from a biological standpoint, we are honoring the temple of the Holy Spirit. But there's such a thing as zoetic energy, spiritual energy that's transformative as well. And so we need to take that very, very seriously as part of the Christian ethic.
Absolutely.
This was what the church fathers taught. This is what the early church taught. This was taught through the time of Luther, and it wasn't until Zwingli that suddenly taking this as the genuine body and blood of Christ was considered bread worship and was considered anathema. And everything has changed now in Christianity. But I think it's rather arrogant for us in the 21st century to say that 1500 or 1600 years of church history had no meaning. It's important for us to be humble enough to get our marching orders from the Lord Jesus Christ, having passed that information on to the apostles to the apostolic fathers, to the holy fathers, and so forth. So I think we need to take church history very, very seriously, and I appreciate the fact that you do so in this book.
Yes, and I honestly think for all Christians, whether you're Orthodox or Catholic or Protestant, this loss of fasting as a, just an ordinary part of the Christian life, we've really lost something. It's not just some dead tradition that we have abandoned, but we've abandoned it at our spiritual detriment. And now it turns out we're now learning it at the beginning of the 21st century to our physical detriment. And so, I mean, that's why I wrote the book, Hank. I'm on a mission to try to convince Christians of whatever tradition that this is something that we need to add as a part of our spiritual Christian walk with the Lord.
I'm hoping and praying and assuming that many people will go through this 46-day period to get started, and I can testify that's transformational. As we wrap things up, walk us through that. You do that in a number of different ways. Obviously, you do that in terms of the formation of the book, but you do that in the table of contents. You do that in the appendix. There are many different ways that you get sort of the skinny on what's going to happen during those 6 weeks.
That's right. The first week is essentially learning to eat ketogenically so that we can rev up the fat-burning part of our metabolism. And so you're just going to get to eat a lot of fat, a lot of natural fat, whatever your favorite forms are, fatty types of meat, and get all of your carbohydrates from green leafy vegetables, pretty much as you want to eat. And by the end of that first week, your body will be using fat for fuels. You'll be in a different metabolic state. And then after that, the second week, you limit the amount of eating to an 8-hour period. So you shift to a 16-8 protocol. Eat for 8 hours during the day and then go 16 without it. Then the next week, you limit it to a 4-hour window. So you're still not trying to cut calories. You can eat all the food you want or that you normally eat during a 4-hour period. Then the next week, you limit it to a 1-hour period. So called one meal a day. You can have a really big meal. And then you're going 23 hours out of the day in a fasted state. And then the next week, so it'd be the fifth week, you actually try the so-called fasting mimicking diet where you do eat a little bit. You eat about 1/4 of what you would normally eat, but it's basically one small meal a day. And I suggest that people do that at least 3 times during the week, but keep eating ketogenically to keep that fat-burning metabolism going up. And then finally in the sixth week, you're really positioned to be able to try a fast from either 36 hours to 72 hours. And a 36-hour fast just basically means if you quit eating say, on a Tuesday night. You don't eat all day on a Wednesday and wait to eat until Thursday morning at breakfast. And a 72-hour fast is, of course, 3 full days. But after that, after the end of that 6 weeks, you'll have all the tools to be able to figure out, okay, how do I want to integrate this permanently into my lifestyle, permanently into my week, and hopefully plug yourself into the traditional Christian liturgical calendar so you can be fasting with the worldwide body of Christ. Because hundreds of millions of people are following that calendar, and it's the sort of easiest way to tap into the fasting patterns that have been a part of the Christian life from the very beginning.
And I suppose that at the end of the day, your prayer would be that all of this is not a program, but it is the way in which the church of the 21st century can become strong again, as opposed to having a weak, impotent church, a church that can conform the culture to Christ.
Absolutely, and amen. That's exactly the point. And just as if you think about Jesus fasting for 40 days in the desert, he was preparing for fighting the forces of darkness in his earthly ministry. And this was like a spiritual boot camp before he started that. It was a 40-day fast in the desert. If it works for him, I'm convinced it can work for us individually as Christians, that it can work for the body of Christ here on earth.
And we are making this book available to everyone listening to the podcast. If you support the ministry of the Christian Research Institute, the Bible Answer Man broadcast, the Hank Unplugged podcast, or 24/7 outreaches around the world, I'd be happy to send you a copy as my gift to you. This is a very readable book. As I said, I've read this book 3 times myself. I put this into practice, and I can tell you it is transformational. And I don't think this is just transformational for a year and then I'm off on to something else. This is going to be a new pattern for the rest of my life. Of course, it coheres with what we do in Orthodoxy with respect to fasting. The case for fasting is made in such a way that you cannot deny it. Just read the book. Again, the book available to those who support the ministry of the Christian Research Institute. You can give in a safe, secure fashion on the web at equip.org. Again, ask for the book. We'll send it out to you as our way of saying thank you. You can also write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Again, you can write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Jay, as always, this has been an enriching time. I am deeply grateful, just on a personal level, that you've written this book, because this book has been transformative for me, and I think it's been a big solution as I've gone through the healing process from a stage 4, very serious and previously thought to be incurable cancer. So I'm grateful to you.
Oh, thank you, Hank. That endorsement means the world to me, and it's been a blessing to you. I hope it can be a blessing to others as well.
I'm certain it will be. Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year to you.
Dr. Jay Richards, again, the book Eat, Fast, Feast, Heal Your Body While Feeding Your Soul, A Christian Guide to Fasting. And there's a little bullet on the front page that says how science is validating an ancient practice. You can read the endorsements on the back of the book, including mine, which once again says Richards is a polymath you can trust. And Eat, Fast, Feast is trustworthy and true. If you're confused about when to eat, when to abstain from eating, don't delay. Read this book today. I did. The results have been transformational. And anyone that sees me can attest to that. I have more energy and strength than I've ever had. And I've just come through an incredible battle with cancer, an unbelievable battle with cancer for 3 years. Now, I could relapse. Anything's possible. Nothing's guaranteed. But I can tell you that this way of eating has allowed me to continue my ministry. This way of making fasting doable for me. I was already fasting according to the Orthodox practice, but this way of fasting intertwined with the proper eating has, again, been transformational. So this is a book that I cannot recommend highly enough. Get your copy. The best way to secure your copy in a safe, secure fashion is on the web at equip.org. And it is available for those who support the ministry of the Christian Research Institute. So you'll be doing two things. You'll be engaging in a transformational process in your own life, but you'll also help to transform the world through the ministry of the Christian Research Institute. So thanks again for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. And once again, make sure that you're subscribing to Hank Unplugged, whether you listen on iTunes, YouTube, or wherever it is you enjoy the podcast. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please do us a favor. Leave a review. That review will encourage other people to listen to the podcast and to extend the reach throughout the world. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of the podcast.